This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Joe Biden said Tuesday that his administration is now considering whether to require U.S. federal employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Biden made the remark during a visit to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence in Virginia as his administration's health experts advised Americans fully vaccinated against COVID-19 to start wearing masks again in some circumstances due to the virus's fast-spreading Delta variant. Biden also said that it would be a different world if all Americans got the vaccine, blaming those who refused to for slowing enormous confusion. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said on Monday that the administration has not made a determination about whether it would be legal for Biden to require federal employees to be vaccinated. The U.S. federal government is the country's largest employer. President plans to announce next steps in the effort to get more Americans to get more shots on Thursday. Meanwhile, according to U.S. health authorities, Americans fully vaccinated against COVID-19 should go back to wearing masks and indoor public places in regions where the coronavirus is spreading rapidly. In a toughening of guidance issued earlier this month, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also recommended all students, teachers, and staff at schools for kindergarten through 12th grade wear masks regardless of whether they're vaccinated or not. The record in COVID-19 cases hit by Tokyo is not a problem for the Olympic Games, according to Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga on Tuesday, adding that they should focus on working from home to suppress the movement of people. Tokyo reported 2,848 COVID-19 infections Tuesday. That's the highest since the pandemic began. This is VOA News. The U.S. government has suspended cooperation with Guatemala's Attorney General's office in response to the firing of its top anti-corruption prosecutor, saying that it has lost confidence in the Central American country's willingness to fight corruption. U.S. State Department Deputy Spokeswoman Jelena Porter told reporters in Washington that the decision by Guatemala Attorney General Consuelo Porras to fire the Juan Francisco Sandoval, the special prosecutor against impunity, fits a pattern of behavior that indicates a lack of commitment to the rule of law and independent judicial and prosecutorial processes. Strong U.S. response was expected at the Sandoval's shocking dismissal on Friday. He has since fled the country. A man accused of killing 8 people, mostly women of Asian descent, at Atlanta area massage businesses pleaded guilty to murder Tuesday and 4 of the killings. He was sentenced to spend the rest of his life in prison. 22-year-old Robert Aaron Long is still facing the death penalty and other deaths, which are being prosecuted in another county. The string of shootings at 3 businesses in March ignited outrage and fueled fear among Asian Americans who already faced increased hostility linked to the coronavirus pandemic. Many were particularly upset when authorities suggested that Long's crimes were not racially motivated, but born out of a sex addiction, which isn't recognized as an official disorder. The UN logistics chief says closing down the joint UN-African Union peacekeeping operation in Sudan's western Darfur region is proceeding on schedule, though with some hiccups. Atul Kher said Tuesday that troops sought asylum in Sudan. Deaths were reported at 10 sites handed over to local authorities, and armed groups are stationing forces around the main remaining logistics base. He told the Security Council the initial milestone for withdrawing peacekeepers and staff by June 30th was achieved. Almost 6,000 soldiers and police and nearly 1,200 staff are gone, and only about 360 police remain. British lawmakers excoriated the government Tuesday for failing victims of the Windrush scandal, accusing officials of ignoring the plight of those whose lives were torn apart when the authorities improperly questioned their right to be in the UK. Parliament's Public Accounts Committee said a compensation program run by the Home Office was overly complex. The Windrush generation, named after the ship that carried the first migrants from the Caribbean in 1948, came to the UK in response to a government call for workers from throughout the British Empire to help rebuild the country after World War II. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Eswatini's government arrests two members of parliament with another on the run.
We wish to voice that our people in Swaziland or Eswatini now wants to have a prime minister who will have executive powers, but that head of government must be elected by the people in a democratic process.
Tunisia's Islamist Al-Nahda party urges dialogue after president suspends the parliament. Malawians rush for COVID-19 vaccine months after expired doses were burned. The UN says armed groups are threatening thousands of Eritrean refugees in Tigray. And Ethiopia's government intensifies recruitment of troops to fight the TPLF.
Recruitment and support for Ethiopia's National Defense Forces has boomed in recent weeks. Several regional administrations are contributing fighters from their militia and the police reserves.
And we'll have a report on hepatitis B infections in Africa. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Authorities in Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, have arrested two members of parliament, and others are on the run for their role in what the police call acts of criminality and violations of the law during recent pro-democracy protests. The U.S. Embassy in Mbabane has expressed concern and called for transparency in the application of the law and to respect human rights. The police say they have arrested 697 people, including two members of parliament. Police have served arrest warrant for another member of parliament, Mduduzi Simelane. From his hiding place somewhere in Eswatini, Simelane says he and the other members of parliament were going to present a resolution in parliament calling for the country's prime minister to be elected by the people.
Let me bring it to your attention that I am a member of parliament in Swaziland. Swaziland is even absolute monarchy. So myself and two of the other members of parliament, we wish to voice that our people in Swaziland or Eswatini now want to have a prime minister or a head of government who will have executive powers. But that head of government with executive powers by the name of prime minister must be elected by the people in a democratic process. Unlike what is currently happening now, term in and term out, only the members of parliament are elected by the people. But the head of government, which is the prime minister, and his executive or her executive is always appointed by the king. And that compromises the lives of our people. We then stood in the parliament and pushed for a system whereby this prime minister must be elected. The authorities of the country, I think they were so infuriated. As a result, they've arrested the two other brothers. Today, I've been told that my warrant of arrest is out.
My understanding is that you and other members of parliament were planning to introduce a motion in parliament. Is that the case? And what exactly is the motion?
The motion we wanted to raise was a motion that will amend the constitution. Actually, the people of Swaziland submitted petition. And demand number one in all these petitions by the people was, we want a prime minister with executive powers that will be accountable and elected by the people. So we said it is time that we move a motion to correct the constitution to allow the people to elect their prime minister the way they have said in their petition. And that is the reason why MPs have been arrested, and myself as well, I'm being followed and chased.
Let me say that a statement from the Swazi police was just texted to me, and in it they referred to the protests and everyone who they say were behind the protests, including two members of parliament. Your name, Mr. Simelane, whose warrant of arrest is in our possession, whom we call upon to surrender himself to the nearest police station. Are you going to surrender yourself?
I just learned today that the warrant of arrest for me is out. Then I have a lot of things to think deeply about, one of which I have evidence that they wanted to assassinate me. So I'm still thinking on a lot of things before I make a decision. But by tomorrow morning, I'll have made the decision.
You mentioned they are trying to assassinate you. You're talking about a government. Any evidence that the government has assassinated people before?
I want to ask a question. Do you believe that a government of a country has released soldiers to shoot to kill 72 unarmed civilians? Do you believe in that?
If that is what you're saying, if it happened, then I believe it.
I'm telling you that it happened. It happened, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago. If they will have the guard to take guns through the armed forces, to be precise, the soldiers, and shoot to kill around 72 unarmed civilians, who are we then?
Mduduzi Simelani is an Eswatini member of parliament who is currently in hiding for fear of being arrested by authorities. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. As the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region spreads, federal forces and their supporters are rushing to recruit troops to fight against forces of the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Ethiopia's Minister of Defense on Tuesday attended a handover of new recruits in the capital, Addis Ababa, from where Galmo Dawit reports.
Recruitment and support for Ethiopia's National Defense Forces has boomed in recent weeks. As the conflict among three regions of northern Ethiopia intensifies, several regional administrations are contributing fighters from their militia and the police reserves. Local administrations are also calling on youths to join the Ethiopian military and fight Tigrayan People's Liberation Front forces, which are labeled as terrorists by the country's parliament. Local administration officials from four districts of Oromia region told VOA that they have registered over 10,000 youths whom are now enrolled in military training. An official ceremony was held Tuesday in Addis Ababa as the recruits prepared to go to training camps. Kanaaya Adeta is Ethiopia's Minister of Defense. He says the TPLF has committed several atrocities on Ethiopians. He says it has also been creating division among Ethiopians. It is an anti-peace lament. Not only that, it is the group that led the attack of the Ethiopian army that has been protecting the nation. Moreover, he says, now it is colluding with the foreign entities to disintegrate Ethiopia. But he says that will not be accomplished. The minister also accepted donations for Ethiopian Defense Forces during the ceremony. The Amhara region has also called on residents of the region to join what it calls the mission of fighting the TPLF. Speaking on the regional TV station Saturday, Amhara Regional President Agenyo Tshagar called on every resident owning a rifle to defend the region. He says, we need to ask ourselves what is expected of us to stand against an enemy that wants to eradicate us from the face of the earth. That is why I'm calling on the residents now. He says he wants everyone who has state-owned rifles, members of the national militia, every individual owning a gun, and all users in the region to go to local administration in their area and join the anti-TPLF mission. Agenyo also revealed that TPLF forces are engaging across Raya, Talemt, Wag, and Welkite areas where there has been a border dispute between Amhara and Tigray for years. He said regional security forces are fighting the TPLF forces together with the Ethiopian National Defense Forces. It is days after neighboring Afar region did the same that the Amhara joined. Last Friday, Awolarba, the Afar regional president called on residents to raise their rifle against the TPLF. Also last week, the Afar region communications office told VOA that over 54,000 people have fled their homes due to the clashes with Tigrayan forces. Ethiopia announced a unilateral ceasefire in Tigray at the end of June. Since then, the TPLF has controlled the region's capital and made gains towards southern Tigray. Regional Tigray officials in the city of Mekele say that they have arrested thousands of Ethiopian soldiers, a claim that officials in Addis Ababa dismiss. But on July 18, the TPLF officials announced the release of over 1,000 low-ranking Ethiopian soldiers. Speaking to Reuters last week, Debretsion Gebremichael, the leader of Tigray People's Liberation Front, said, yet there are more than 5,000 Ethiopian soldiers with them, and they will keep the senior officers who will face the trial. On Saturday, the Tigray Regional Council held its meeting for the first time since the recent conflict broke out. Debretsion Gebremichael said, though several unprecedented things happened in the region, now the struggle of the people of Tigray is paying off. Galmo Dawit, VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says about 24,000 Eritrean refugees trapped in two camps in northern Ethiopia's Tigray province are in great danger as fighting among armed groups escalates. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Concerns are growing for the safety and well-being of thousands of Eritrean refugees in Mai Eni and Adi Harush camps as fighting intensifies in Tigray's Mai Sebri area. The UN Refugee Agency reports aid agencies have been unable to access the camps since July 14th. It says conditions for the refugees have become increasingly dire and worrisome since then. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says members of armed groups have infiltrated the camps. He says the Eritreans are living in constant fear. He says they are facing intimidation and harassment and are cut off from humanitarian assistance.
We have received disturbing and credible reports in recent days from my Eni refugee camp that at least one refugee was killed by armed elements operating inside the camp. The latest death is in addition to the killing of another refugee on 14th of July.
Baluch says he does not know which of the armed groups is responsible for the killings. However, his agency, he says, has received credible reports that people with guns are operating inside the two refugee camps. He says the UNHCR has been appealing to the local authorities and the Ethiopian Refugee Agency to provide safety for the refugees and to grant aid agencies access to the camps. He notes the Eritrean refugees have been without humanitarian assistance for the last 2 weeks.
Trapped refugees need urgent life-saving assistance. Clean drinking water is running out. No healthcare services are available, and hunger is a real danger. The last food distribution to both refugee camps was done in late June, which provided them rations for just 1 month.
Baluch says recent armed clashes in Afar region to the east of Tigray have displaced thousands of people, among them about 55,000 Eritrean refugees. He says concerns for their safety also are growing as armed confrontations are taking place near where the refugees live. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 28. Tunisia's Islamist Al-Nada Party is calling President Kais Saied's suspension of parliament a coup and urging a broad dialogue, while other political parties and leaders appear divided over his decision. A number of trade syndicates, including the Labour Federation, say they support the move so long as it does not last more than a month. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Tunisian state TV reported that the situation inside the country was calm Tuesday following President Kais Saied's decision Sunday to suspend parliament. It said Tunisians were largely obeying a curfew that forbids more than three people from gathering in the streets during the night. Most government institutions, with the exception of security forces, interior ministry, and customs, were also suspended for several days. The president met with political and trade union leaders to discuss his next move amid calls by some for a well-defined roadmap. The Tunisian president told a roundtable Monday night that he had been patient for a long time, but that some provocateurs were trying to destroy government institutions from within. He asked for calm and urged citizens to avoid provocations. Democracy is important, he said, but the poor have no rights. Islamist Parliament Speaker Rashid al-Ghannouchi told supporters to suspend their protest in front of Parliament to avoid bloodshed. His al-Nahda party called the president's suspension of Parliament a coup, but urged all political parties to hold a dialogue. Peter Johnson, a former U.S. diplomat who now works in Tunisia, tells VOA that he doesn't see a clear-cut answer as to whether the president's move was legal or not.
I would say it's definitely a gray area. It's not really clear black or white, because this is something that Article 80 gives him the power as commander-in-chief of the military, the power of national security, of protecting the borders, of diplomacy. However, at the same time, that same section of the Constitution talks about his power to remove certain government officials, but not to completely suspend Parliament.
Johnson points out that the Constitution also gives Parliament the right to remove the president with a two-thirds vote, so the president short-circuited a major check and balance. But he argues the Tunisian public seems broadly supportive of Syed's move so far.
The Tunisian people seem broadly supportive of it so far. I hear from many, many friends and from seeing the celebrations in the streets that people were very frustrated by the stalemate and the inaction of this current government or this past government.
Fatih Al-Ayadi, a spokesman for the Islamist Al-Nahda party, told Qatar's Al Jazeera TV that the best way to avoid the threats to the country that President Syed says he is trying to prevent is a return to normal constitutional procedures and a return to democracy in the political process. Outspoken Tunisian Member of Parliament Abir Moussi applauded the president for sidelining the Al-Nahda party, while Oussam Khalifi of the Heart of Tunisia party thanked him for his wise leadership and for acting swiftly. The head of the Tunisian Workers' Party, however, claimed the president was misleading the people. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Malawians have been lining up since Monday to get vaccinated against the coronavirus. Malawi ran out of doses in June amid a rise in COVID-19 infections, and just weeks after the government burned 20,000 unused doses that expired because of vaccine hesitancy. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The Malawi government reopened its vaccination program Monday after the arrival of 192,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine. Since then, the vaccination centers have seen long lines of people, unlike the past, when some centers would only vaccinate 2 people per day. Lisnet Chirungo is among thousands who lined up for vaccinations Tuesday at the youth center in Blantyre. She says, "I have decided to get vaccinated this time because the COVID infection is now becoming very scary and many people are dying than before." She says she had hesitated because she doubted the efficacy and safety of the AstraZeneca vaccine due to myths and misinformation. George Jobe is executive director for the Malawi Health Equity Network. He says the huge turnout confirms the fear and panic people have about rising cases of COVID-19, and there are other factors.
The first factor could be that those who received the first jab and second jab are still in good health, including the state president and the vice president. Contrary to the misinformation and myths that were there, that should have affected the mindset of people over the COVID-19 vaccine.
Also, preliminary results of a survey by the Ministry of Health show that over 80% of COVID-19 patients who are admitted to public hospitals are not vaccinated. However, Malawi is far from inoculating the 11 million people needed to reach herd immunity. Records from the Public Health Institute of Malawi show that just 43,165 people have received 2 doses of vaccine. Another 385,000 have received just the first shot. Charles Mansambo is the secretary for the Ministry of Health. He says people most vulnerable to the coronavirus should get vaccinated first.
Because we'll be getting enough vaccines for everybody. So I would recommend that let's give a chance to health workers. Let's give a chance to those over the age of 60. Let's also give a chance to those with conditions like high blood pressure, blood sugar, to come first. And the rest of us, we can wait.
The Minister of Health announced last week that in addition to 192,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine, which arrived Saturday, Malawi is also expected to receive 119,000 more doses of AstraZeneca vaccine before the end of the month. The country is also expected to receive donations of 300,000 Pfizer vaccine doses and 300,000 Johnson & Johnson doses in early August. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
At least 50 million people are chronic carriers of the hepatitis B virus, with mortality risk of 25% in Africa. The World Health Organization says hepatitis B carrier rates in sub-Saharan Africa range from 9 to 20%, with transmission occurring predominantly in children. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, about 2% of Kenya's population is affected by the virus.
The Center for Disease Control, CDC, estimates that at least 350 million people worldwide live with hepatitis, with at least five types of hepatitis: type A, B, C, D, and E. Hepatitis B, C, and D are most likely to become chronic, with one person dying every 30 seconds from a hepatitis-related illness worldwide. Reproductive health specialist Dr. Kegan Batilol from Kenya said that hepatitis B is more common, affecting at least 2.5% of the Kenyan population.
Hepatitis, particularly hepatitis B, is one of the key reproductive health issues that we do have. It is sexually transmitted, and unlike the other forms of sexually transmitted, this is one of the transmission of the disease that is actually not controlled by the use of condom. In our population, hepatitis B is at about the percentage of about 2.5% of the population.
Viral hepatitis causes more than 1 million deaths each year across the world, and while deaths from tuberculosis and HIV have been declining, deaths from hepatitis are increasing. Dr. Kegan said that government should give vaccines to children and people at a high risk of contracting the disease in order to control the rate of infections.
So we find that the other ones, hepatitis A, tends to be less common because this is more of an infectious disease. The other two are quite rare in our population. As we always say, prevention is better than cure. So for us, we say that since the hepatitis B vaccine is there, it's a routine vaccine within our system, in the health system in Kenya, as a childhood vaccine. We also want to give the vaccine to particularly health workers who are at a higher risk of getting the hepatitis B infection.
Hepatitis E is usually acute but very dangerous in pregnant women. Dr. Kegan recommends that frequent screening, especially for people of reproductive age, is important.
So we normally want to screen so that we can prevent the baby from getting the hepatitis by giving of immunoglobulins at the time of delivery. Long-term effect is that once you get into chronic hepatitis or hepatitis B infection, is that you tend to need to go into antiretrovirals. And these antiretrovirals are actually given for life. So you can see this is a product, it's a reproductive health issue affecting the liver that require chronic treatment for life. If no treatment, you tend to progress into the severe form of the disease. You can go into hepatic, chronic hepatitis with hepatic failure. So really, we need to do more screening, maybe in the general population.
With this year's hepatitis theme being hepatitis can't wait, research from CDC shows that excessive alcohol consumption can also cause liver damage and inflammation, which is sometimes referred to as alcohol hepatitis, whereby the alcohol directly injures the cells of the liver. Other toxic causes of hepatitis include overuse and overdose of medications and exposure to poisons. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
And that's it for this Wednesday, July 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, saying have a great day.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the youth-led uprisings we've seen across Africa in recent years. As young people take to the streets and social media to demand change, we ask, have they been effective and what have the mass uprisings really accomplished? Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.